This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Jim Bertel. U.S. President Joe Biden and European Union leaders are expressing dismay over the news Sunday that Myanmar security forces opened fire on a funeral Sunday, a day after more than 100 people were killed during protests against the February military coup. Meanwhile, defiant protesters returned to the streets of Myanmar Monday. AP's Karen Chamas reports.
Demonstrators in Yangon chanted in unison as they marched down the street, charged with anger by the crackdown the day before. Of the over 100 people killed, several were children under 16 years old. People came out in force in Dawei and Mandalay and were again met with police force. The number of killings since the coup has now totaled over 420, according to multiple counts. The recent violence by police and soldiers took place throughout the country as Myanmar's military celebrated the annual Armed Forces Day holiday with a parade in the country's capital, Naypyidaw. The bloodshed quickly drew international condemnation both from diplomatic missions within Myanmar and from abroad. I'm Karen Chamas.
Egyptian authorities say they will use more powerful tugboats to try to, again on Monday, to remove from the Suez Canal one of the world's largest container ships, which has blocked the key shipping trade route for nearly a week. Authorities hope to take advantage of high tide on Monday to dislodge the giant container ship known as the Evergreen. Diggers worked Sunday night into Monday to remove part of the canal's bank to help free the giant container ship. So far, 27,000 cubic meters of sand and mud have been removed. For more on this story, go to voanews.com. From Washington, this is VOA News. The Mozambican Defense Ministry says that dozens of people were killed during coordinated jihadi attacks in Palma in northern Mozambique 4 days after the attacks. The Defense Ministry spokesman told a news conference that seven people were killed during an operation to evacuate them from a hotel where they had sought refuge during the raid. He said in the past few days, government security forces have prioritized the rescue of hundreds of citizens, nationals, and foreigners. The unknown number of militants began attacking the town, a gas hub, on Wednesday, forcing nearly 200 people to take refuge at a hotel, with others taking cover in the nearby tropical forest. Human Rights Watch said the militants indiscriminately shot civilians in their homes and on the streets. The militant attack on Palma is the closest yet to the major gas project during a three-year Islamist insurgency across Mozambique's north. Bangladesh security forces opened fire and used tear gas Sunday to disperse thousands of protesters who were enforcing a nationwide general strike that they had called to denounce violence at a previous protest over a visit by India's prime minister. At least one man was shot after thousands of protesters, mostly students from Islamic schools, blocked a major highway connecting Dhaka with the southeastern port city of Chattogram. Witnesses said scores of people were hurt in clashes with police. A year after becoming a global epicenter of the coronavirus pandemic, New York and New Jersey are back atop the list of U.S. states with the highest rates of infection. AP's Julie Walker reports.
Even as vaccines continue to ramp up, the number of new infections in both states has crept up. New Jersey is averaging about 23,600 every 7 days. New York, 50,000 per week. Neither state is experiencing anything like what they saw last spring when hospitals and morgues were overflowing. And like the rest of the country, both are in a much better place than in January at the peak of the pandemic's winter spike. But the lack of improvement or even backsliding in recent weeks has raised concerns. The states are opening too quickly and people are letting their guard down, just as potentially more contagious variants of the virus are circulating. Julie Walker, New York.
For more information on the coronavirus or for more details on any of today's top news, please go to voanews.com or use the easy-to-use VOA mobile app. From Washington, via remote, I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbate in Washington. Today is Monday, March 29th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sudan inches one step closer to comprehensive peace with its rebel groups.
We think it is a good agreement as the first step going forward to the comprehensive peace agreement in Sudan. And then finally, we hope we can make all the national conference how we can deal with our problems in Sudan.
The UN finds Eritrean refugee camps in northern Tigray destroyed and abandoned. Kenyans react to the reintroduction of COVID-19 restrictions, and the saga of the stranded container ship in the Suez Canal continues.
There are lots of people working on this. It's very important that this be resolved sooner rather than later, not only for trade issues, but also for security issues.
We'll also talk about the impact of the ship on East African shipping businesses and Lesotho's health minister on lessons learned from a public-private partnership. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Justice Party of Sudan says it hopes that Sunday's agreement between the Sudan government and the Sudan People's Liberation Movement North, the SPLMN, is yet another step towards achieving comprehensive peace and national reconciliation in Sudan. Sudan's power-sharing government, led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, has been trying to reach agreement with the country's rebel groups so as to end years of conflict. Justice Party Vice President Bushara Guma Aroa says he hopes the group who have yet to sign the agreement would exercise their historic responsibility to do so.
We think it is a good agreement as the first step going forward to the comprehensive peace agreement in Sudan. And then finally, we hope we can make all the national conference how we can deal with our problems in Sudan.
There was an agreement signed last year between the Sudanese government and the other rebel groups. Why did it take this Numba Mountain group this long to sign this agreement?
I think they have their own opinions and they may be afraid about the past agreements which has been in the Sudan with the past government or regime. So maybe they have some points and they want to find how they can find some agreement about when we come to make a peace agreement, we really can be believe that can be implemented on the ground.
The agreement emphasizes religion, freedom of religion. Can you speak to that for me? And how would this make this new government different from the government of former President Bashir?
This diplomacy, my friend, it is not an issue. Because in Sudan, there is no fear. Everyone can have his own religion. There is no problem here. So therefore now, we as Justice Party, we make now a press conference about this point of this agreement. So we think the religion is here in Sudan. Everyone can get what he needed. But sometimes the politicians use this point as a tactics between them. So maybe they kind of afraid about how it was at that time used in the political issues.
What does this mean now for Sudan in terms of moving forward?
I think it means it is a second step after the Juba peace agreement. I think now this point with Abdelaziz and we wait Abdelwahid to complete the comprehensive peace agreement in Sudan. And then we hope that all the Sudanese people, if they are politicians as parties or armed movement, armies group or whatever we talk about, they are now looking forward to the peace. And after that, we are trying to find a way, a solution, how we can make the comprehensive national conference to find a way, how we can make a solution for our problems, the chronic problems in Sudan.
The agreement was signed in Juba. How would you describe the role that South Sudan is playing, a country that has its own problem?
Yeah, you see, South Sudan and the Sudan now, they were one country. So the South Sudan, which is now playing the role of mediator for this peace agreement, they know well about each one problems, and they know well even personally for those leaders.
Bushara Guma Aroa is vice president of the Justice Party of Sudan. He was speaking with us from the capital, Khartoum. Egypt's Suez Canal Authority made another effort over the weekend to refloat a giant container ship that is blocking traffic in a main artery of the canal and disrupting world trade, which passes through the strategic waterway. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Around-the-clock efforts are continuing for a fourth straight day to refloat a giant 400-meter-long container ship, the Ever Given, which has been blocking a main canal artery since Tuesday. Usama Rabia, who heads the Suez Canal Authority, told journalists at a press conference Saturday that persistent efforts are being made to get the Ever Given back on course because 321 ships are waiting to go through the canal. He says that we know the depth of the canal at the point where the ship is blocked is about 24 meters in its midsection, but it is considerably less deep along the sides, so the ship must be made lighter to refloat it, and work is continuing 24 hours a day and not just 8 hours to do this. He went on to say that 9,000 tons of water have been removed to lighten the ship, and large quantities of sand have been dredged from around the ship. It is not immediately clear if efforts will be made to start removing some of the 20,000 containers the ship is carrying. Egyptian Prime Minister Mustafa Madbouly told Egyptian TV Saturday that Egypt has been trying to make use of all the expertise available to resolve the current crisis on the Suez Canal. He says that everyone knows the course of the Suez Canal is quite precise and exacting, and what the depths are in different places and how ships need to transit these areas, such that there is a core of experts to deal with different types of ships and how to maneuver them. Madbouly went on to say that given the serious nature of the accident, the canal authority deployed all its resources from the very outset of the crisis, in addition to appealing to international experts. Paul Sullivan, a professor at the Washington-based U.S. National Defense University, tells VOA the world is waiting with bated breath for the crisis to be resolved.
There are lots of people working on this, non-Egyptian experts, Egyptian experts, the Suez Canal Authority, many others. It's very important that this be resolved sooner rather than later, not only for trade issues, but also for security issues, because the longer this goes on, the longer that canal will not be available for vessels related to world security.
Sullivan noted that if more and more ships are going along the coast of Africa because of this incident, security arrangements would need to be tightened in places where pirates are known to operate, such as the Gulf of Guinea, off the coast of Somalia, and between Somalia and Yemen. The Japanese-owned container ship Ever Given, which is blocking the canal, could possibly sag under the stress of its 20,000 container cargo if it remains blocked for a long period of time. The ship also may have suffered structural damage in 2019 when it hit a ferry near the port of Hamburg in Germany. Egypt is eager to resume traffic along the Suez Canal, which brings in between $5 and $6 billion each year in revenues. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
As work continues to free up a stranded cargo ship in the Suez Canal, Sylvester Kututa, chairperson of Kenya Shipping Agents Association, addresses the impact on shipping business from East African ports.
Of course, there are many effects that has happened to the trade by sea from East Africa. We know that in the old days, there was a lot of imports from Europe, Mediterranean, and the UK to East Africa and Southern Africa through the Suez Canal. But in terms of imports today, we see more of East African and Southern African, and indeed African imports coming more from China, and therefore we don't expect very much, a lot. Yes, indeed, there will be an effect, but not very much. A lot of exports from East Africa, a lot of exports from Southern Africa. Let's say East Africa exporting tea and East Africa exporting coffee. which are our major commodities, including also reefer cargoes like avocados, which we in Kenya are very good at exporting to Europe, French ports mainly. These are going to be very much affected because they are shipped on a weekly basis out into Egypt. And we know that Egypt is a major consumer of Eastern African tea, and also the UK. And when we come to coffee, there's a lot of coffee going into the Mediterranean ports and northwest continent of Europe. So these are definitely affected because this is traffic that passes and goes through the Suez Canal. And as long as this continues, their supply chains will be very much affected. Either there will be cancellation of orders, or there will be delayed orders, or some will be airlifted, or they will have to use the longer route through South Africa and West Africa.
That was Sylvester Kututa, chairperson of Kenya Shipping Agents Association. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, March 29th. Kenya has reintroduced restrictive measures to combat the spread of coronavirus in the country. Kenya has locked down the capital and surrounding counties. The country's positivity rate last week stood at 22%, a 20% increase in just under 2 months. Mohammed Yusuf reports for VOA from Nairobi.
Addressing the nation Friday, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta put the capital, Nairobi, and surrounding counties under lockdown.
But fully conscious that 70% of Kenya's reported cases of COVID-19 have been recorded in the counties of Nairobi, Kajiado, Machakos, Kiambu, and Nakuru, these counties are individually and collectively declared a disease-infected area. That there shall be a cessation of all movement by road, rail, or air into and out of the disease-infected area as one zoned area.
Recent COVID-19 testing measures the positivity rate at 22%, a 20% jump from January. Nairobi is leading with 6 in 10 people testing positive. 32-year-old Obadiah Langat, a Nairobi resident, is rushing home after attending a burial. He is in a rush to beat a nighttime curfew.
We are traveling for a burial. More than 20 kilometers out of Eldoret. Now we are entering Eldoret. We don't know how, because we don't know how we are going to make it to Nairobi. So it's sad for us. It's shocking.
Kenyatta explains why it is necessary to control the movement of people in and out of 5 counties.
If you test 100 Kenyans for COVID, 20 will be positive. This compared to January this year, when only 2 would have been positive. And this tells us that our rate of infection has gone up 10 times between January and March of 2021.
Kenya has also banned public gatherings, reduced curfew hours, people eating in restaurants, and ordered bars to be closed. Simon Njoroge is the chairman of the Kenya Bars and Hotels Association, and he says only vaccination can save them from frequent shutdowns.
We don't want to comment so much on the directives of today, because we have to sit down and go back to the drawing board. But as a chair, I would like to tell the government that yes, there is corona, there is COVID-19, and the directives have been followed. But I wish the government would have come forward and give vaccination to our staff guys, to our people.
In early March, Kenya received 1.1 million vaccine doses. About 50,000 people have received the jabs. Kenya has recorded 125,000 coronavirus cases and 2,100 deaths. Authorities say the latest measures will remain until further notice. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The UN Refugee Agency says 2 refugee camps for Eritreans in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region have been destroyed and abandoned. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UN agencies have been unable to access Tigray since November, when Ethiopia began its military offensive to wrest control of the region from the Tigray People's Liberation Front. Aid workers finally were allowed to reach two refugee camps, Shimelba and Hitsat, that had been out of bounds for months. The UNHCR and UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs conducted a joint mission to the area recently and found both camps had been destroyed. UNHCR spokesman Boris Cheshakov says the camps, which formerly housed some 20,000 Eritrean refugees, were deserted and all the humanitarian facilities had been looted and vandalized.
In Hitsats, most of the shelters in an area known as Zone A, as well as UNHCR's offices and staff guest house, were burned to the ground. The mission confirmed what satellite imagery and accounts from refugees had indicated at the beginning of this year. UNHCR is deeply concerned for the well-being of the Eritrean refugees who had been residing there, all of whom have fled the camps.
Earlier in the crisis, more than 7,000 of the refugees had fled the camps for security reasons and headed for two other Eritrean refugee camps that were not directly affected by the conflict. Cheshakov says his agency has been in contact with more than 2,000 other refugees who have fled to various parts of the country for safety.
We have around 7 to 10,000 Eritrean refugees still dispersed in the region, and also in places where we have not yet had access, but we are working to identify where they are and to provide them with support, working, of course, closely with our partners and with the authorities.
Local authorities have reported the presence of some 95,000 Ethiopians who are internally displaced within Tigray's Shiraro administrative area. Cheshakov says all the refugees, as well as Ethiopian displaced, are in dire need of urgent life-saving assistance, including food, shelter, health care, water, and sanitation. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Lesotho's health minister says he hopes that other African countries who might want to enter into a public-private partnership may first want to study Lesotho's experience before doing so. Last week, Health Minister Simano Sikato severed Lesotho's 18-year private-public partnership, the PPP, with the Sepon Consortium that was managing the Queen Mamohato Memorial Hospital in Maseru. Minister Sikato says the consortium, founded by the South African healthcare group Netcare, was gobbling up half of Lesotho's healthcare budget. He says the straw that broke the camel's back was the consortium's decision to fire nurses who were on strike to demand salary increments.
The beginning, the agreement was never understood by many people in Lesotho. It was a little bit of a foreign agreement. For example, you wouldn't expect in Lesotho to have patient queuing for services. Ever since the inception of TEPO, these things have been happening and Basotho have been patient. There are many other things that TEPO has done that are not appropriate. For instance, the composition of the board leaves a lot to be desired, and it flies against all corporate governance rules, where you have people who are supposed to report to the board being members as well of the board. Now, Tepong has been awarded to Netcare, the management wing of the company. Yet, a de facto manager is also on the board of Tepong. So, whatever the board members say or instruct him to do, he can easily refuse. And Netcare is doing well when the board is in disarray.
Minister, nurses at Sepong have been on strike over salary increment. Will they get their salary increment now? And what about their jobs?
Once we have gone through this bitter divorce, we are going to re-employ those nurses, re-engage them into the government service. If not, at a new arrangement at Sepong, they will get their jobs back.
Who is going to be running Sepong Hospital now? The government?
Once we are over with the divorce, we'll run Sepong as government and temporarily so, hoping that we could get another good operator. It's just that we got into a bad agreement, and we also were in bed with a company that has no regard and respect for sovereignty and the people of Lesotho.
What lessons, Mr. Minister, do you think Lesotho has learned from this experience in terms of who should be in charge of running a major health facility like Sepon?
What we have learned most from this experience is that we shouldn't take advice on face value. We were wrongly advised to enter into this. Now, today, those who advise us to have this agreement saying, no, you are on your own. They have abandoned us, and we have to learn to swim on our own. So it's a good learning experience for Africa. All our researchers, they have to come here and study what has happened.
That was Lesotho's health minister, Simano Sikato, speaking with us from the capital, Maseru. Now for Daybreak Africa's Pulse, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with results from the qualifying matches in the African Cup of Nations 2021 being played across various venues this past weekend. South Africa failed to qualify for the 2021 African Cup of Nations in Cameroon after losing 2-0 to Sudan on Sunday in the final round Group C match in Omdurman. Ghana defeated Sao Tome Principe 3-1 in Accra in the match played at the same time to finish first with 13 points, followed by Sudan with 12 points, while South Africa had 10 points and Sao Tome no points at all. Sudan qualified for only the third time in 23 attempts behind Ghana. Failure to qualify for the 2021 tournament in Cameroon means Bafana Bafana will miss the finals of the Continental Showpiece for the fourth time in 7 editions. Most South Africans are not happy with their national team.
I'm very, very disappointed with our coach. We had a very weak Ghana. Ever seen Ghana like this? Ever. We couldn't take an advantage of Ghana. We plan to play a draw against Ghana. And then we tell ourselves that we're going to go to Sudan and win.
And I think with regards to Bafana Bafana is Mule Fenteki. I have to be very honest and say that I have been thoroughly disappointed within his reign as Bafana Bafana coach. I think there were times where tactics you could question, selections you would question in terms of the players that were chosen as well. Game plan too, you would sort of question. And then there was that big statement that he made regarding the fact that you can't call up some of the European players because of social cohesion.
Yeah, it's a tough one. We all saw it, but we didn't want to put injustice to the situation. But so far, I for one was hoping for a draw with the best, maybe that maybe the worst that could happen, maybe it was with just a draw, and we couldn't even get a draw.
Earlier, Tunisia beat Equatorial Guinea 2-1 in raids in the match between countries who had already qualified from Group J, while Tanzania edged Libya 1-0 in Dar es Salaam in the same section. Guinea, who secured a place at the 2014 tournament earlier this week, surrendered an unbeaten Group A record when losing 2-1 to Namibia in Windhoek. 8 matches have been slated to be played today, while on Tuesday another 10 matches will be played to conclude the qualifying matches and determine the 24 teams that will feature at the 2021 African Cup of Nations in Cameroon. Cameroon's Francis Ngwonu made history on Saturday, becoming the first African mixed martial fighter to capture the UFC heavyweight gold with a devastating finish over Stipe Miocic at the UFC 260. The bout was a rematch of their 2018 meeting at UFC 220, where American Miocic dominated Ngwonu over 5 rounds for a landslide unanimous decision victory in Boston. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, March 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a great week.